are three podiums that you can argue from. The ones right next to your tables are the one in the middle that goes up and down. Your choice as to which one you want to use. Each will have 15 minutes for argument with 5 minutes for rebuttal. Would you please call the case?
Our next case today, A220898, Jonathan G. Foss versus Mark Scott Savage and Susan Foss et al.
And it's case eight, maybe you already said this, A22? Gotcha. Okay, so please state your name at the beginning of your argument and the party that you're representing. And with that, attorney for appellant, are you ready?
I am, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Your Honors. My name is John Uretsky, and along with Pulp Law Firm and Thoma Ellingson, I represent appellant Mark Scott Savage. I'd like to start with sort of a roadmap of the relief requested here. The appellant asks this court to reverse the judgment and remand for a new trial based on, one, the erroneous entry of summary judgment on appellant's common law fraud and civil theft counterclaims, two, the erroneous entry of judgment of a matter of law on appellant's rescission and conversion counterclaims, three, the erroneous exclusion of appellant's universal settlement claim, and four, the erroneous denial of appellant's motion for a new trial, where the jury was improperly instructed, awarded excessive damages, and the cumulative effect of the district court's erroneous evidentiary rulings prevented appellant from receiving a full and fair opportunity to be heard at trial. There are a few key facts that hopefully the court will focus on here. First, as a sort of summary, this dispute arises from a series of investments in stock in what are known as microcap companies, which are just really, really, really small companies. They have, you know, a couple of people working at them. They've got very, very little money to start. That the appellee, Mr. Foss, made by and through appellant, Mr. Mark Savage. Now, some investments were structured as loans from appellee to appellant to purchase stock. Some were purchased directly with Mr. Savage. What I really need the court to focus on is when you make a direct investment with a microcap company, it's always a direct investment. You can't go to Merrill Lynch, you can't go to Schwab and just buy one of these companies. The difference is, picture Coca-Cola. You are able to buy Coca-Cola through whoever your brokerage account may be. You can't, or you can try, but I don't think you can go to Atlanta and go up and knock on the CEO's door and say, can I have some stock in Coca-Cola? But that is exactly what you need to do to get these shares of the microcap companies. Since that's not really feasible, someone like Mark Savage puts himself there. If you want to do that, I know the CEOs. I can get you in touch. So that's a direct investment because you're not using a broker as your intermediary. That's a key fact. All of the investments are direct investments. The other key fact that I'd really like the court to focus on is the difference between what we'll just call common shares and consulting shares. Both are at issue here in this case, but common shares, that's the kind you would normally get if you went and you invested. And the thing is, the SEC has a rule where these are restricted for 6 months. You can't do anything with them for those 6 months. You can have them, but they're useless to you until after the 6 month period. There's also something called consulting shares. And the companies, they save these, and then after the 6 month period, they are freely tradable, and then they have a value. And then the company itself uses them because they said, like I said, they don't have a lot of money. They use them to pay their business consultants like Mark Savage. Since they don't have actual cash flow, they say, would you be willing to accept payment in shares instead? If it was common shares, Mr. Savage would say, no, they're worthless. If he can trade them and immediately sell them and make $10,000 that way, he would say yes. And that's his business, effectively.
I want to, with that factual background in mind, and we've all read the briefing and the other materials, which are extensive, I want to focus in. I mean, this is at its heart a breach of contract claim. You, as I understand, your client had claims submitted to the jury that that the respondent breached the contract, and there were competing claims. What is it about the facts here? What I'm trying to ask is, why did the district court err by dismissing sort of the your tort counterclaims that are all seem to be related to the alleged breach of contract?
That's a great question, because what it does is it actually notes the difference between the tort and the contract claims, and where I disagree with Your Honor is that they are necessarily related. I think obviously they're all out of the same.
Well, for example, the fraud claim, and that was dismissed on summary judgment, and you're asking us to reverse that. As I understand it, the claimed fraud was misrepresentations by the respondent with respect to, well, I will buy all the shares of these microcap companies or something along that line. My question is more pointed, and that is, what competent evidence did you submit in opposing the summary judgment motion seeking to dismiss the fraud claim that the district court ignored?
Well, for one thing, the district court ignored the pleadings. And if
but the pleadings are not evidence, right? I mean, that might save you at the Rule 12 stage, you know, where the court is required to assume the facts as alleged in the pleadings to be true. But at summary judgment is the time where you have to come forward with actual evidence that could be admitted at trial. And I'm asking, with respect to the fraud claim and maybe the other claim dismissed on summary judgment, civil theft, what evidence did you submit to the district court in opposition to the summary judgment motion?
I'm going to get there in a second, Your Honor. I will address that directly. I just want to call the court's attention to Fabio versus Belomo, 504 Northwest 2nd, 758, which my reading indicates the allegations of the pleading may not be disregarded, and the court must accept as true the factual allegations of the counterclaim. And to
our
answer,
case law, though, establishes that you can't rely on mere averments.
Now to address it directly, I wanted to get that out there. What we did was we indicated that there's a difference between the future and the present funding rounds. There was testimony in actually more than one deposition that there were present funding rounds where shares were set aside, and that Mr. Jonathan Foss promised that he would fulfill the entire funding round but did not. And it's that testimony.
And where, what testimony was that? Where in the record can you point me? Because I have not been able to find that evidence that defeats summary judgment.
I may have to get that for you on rebuttal. I don't have that with me right now. It was, I believe, actually, though, both the deposition of Mr. Savage and Mr. Foss. But I'll try to get you a cite for rebuttal.
And as I recall, the district court was concerned that there was general testimony, but not the testimony that says when the statement was made, exactly what was made, what representations were made. And, of course, on the fraud claim, you have to have that level of specificity to prevail.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, that level of specificity is in the pleadings. What happened was Mr. Savage wasn't asked for that much detail during his deposition. He answered the question that he was asked, but he wasn't asked all that much. It's, I believe, one or two pages of his deposition at most. And assuming that you can simply dismiss one's claims based on a question that they were not asked, I don't believe gives the individual a full and fair opportunity to be heard. And looking at, this is de novo review, you know, with the light most favorable to Mr. Savage as the non-moving party, which is what the court had to do, and I believe what this court needs to do as well. I believe looking only at the one or two questions that he was asked doesn't give him that full and fair opportunity to be heard. You need to look at his pleadings under the Fabio case. In his pleadings, for example, he alleges, that Mr. Foss made representations about providing full funding that were false, that allowed him to presently obtain shares which had been set aside for providers of those funds that were material, that he knew were false, that Foss made intending to get him into those agreements, and induced him to enter into the agreements and caused him harm. That's docket number 30. I can give you the paragraphs. I believe it's 78 to 90, 93 to 94, 369 to 74. And we would disagree that the allegations of the pleading may be disregarded. Just want to move on a bit.
But what I saw in the deposition, so you're not exactly sure when Mr. Foss first made the representation that he would fully fund any transaction that you brought to him. Answer from your client. I'm not exactly sure. No, that's right. And so my understanding from the record was that it was contingent on some other things happening before he would fully fund the transactions. Am I wrong in that understanding?
Yes. The promise was that he would fully fund the transaction, Your Honor. What needs to then happen is, to be fair to Mr. Foss, he doesn't need to give all of the money immediately. There's a funding round, meaning it's a present set-aside amount of shares, and let's say you need this is a made-up number for my math, needs $100 to get all of those shares purchased. There is no requirement that Mr. Foss had to give all $100 right away. He only potentially needed to give $25. It was his promise that he would later pay the other $75 to accumulate the full 100 within that period of time set aside for those shares for that round.
Is it fair to say that those promises you're talking about now are not reflected in the actual contract documents?
Oh, of course not. That's the case in a nutshell. Well, I guess there's more to it than that, Your Honor. But that's a lot of the case, yes.
These arguments are very short, and I want to ask you to talk a little bit about the jury's award of damages so that I understand your challenge. I read your brief to sort of be making the suggestion that the jury was acting under passion and prejudice, but then I also read it as just that there was not sufficient evidence on the question of damages. Can you help me understand what your argument is? And do you contend that there was no evidence to support the damages that the jury awarded?
There is evidence to support certain amounts of it, Your Honor, but certainly not the whole amount.
Which ones are supported?
The $4.8 million that are, it's the majority, and they all focus on these fake, non-existent, imaginary shares. That's the problem. We have issues with the remainder. But
is your argument that these are fake, imaginary shares that never existed, is that a legal argument or a factual argument?
It's a factual argument, I suppose, but it was already conceded by both their expert in tracing, who could have traced these, but they don't exist, John Foss himself, who indicated that they don't exist, and literally everyone. There was tons of time for discovery. There was a huge process here. Simply put, these shares never existed, and Mr. Foss knows that they never existed. And the jury, because of a number of decisions made by the district court that we believe require a new trial, the jury didn't know about that to the extent that they should have, and because of the precluding of the expert, they weren't able to have a full calculation dealing with that 4.8 and how the rest should have been calculated.
But you'd acknowledge that the respondent and respondent's expert did provide testimony and forensic accounting reports that support the jury's verdict?
Did
answers to numbers 4 and 5 on the verdict form?
Not nearly enough. We were limited. The expert, Mr. Don Kaiser, he's sitting in the back, he wasn't actually able. You're right. I did the best I could as the trial lawyer to then work around the rulings by the court, sure. But what I was forced to do was not have him use the second half of his report. I had to cut it in half. I had to have him go up to a whiteboard and try to do things from memory. He wasn't given the opportunity to do, I think, what we expect an expert to do. Whereas the expert for Mr. Foss was, and to be fair, he is an expert in tracing. He admitted that he didn't look to see if these shares existed. He, at best, took it straight from Mr. Foss that they existed. Mr. Foss himself admitted he just wrote them into the contract, even though he wasn't sure that he existed, and he admitted that there were mistakes in the amounts. These things don't exist. They are imaginary, and because of the decisions by the district court, the jury wasn't able to properly understand the nature or the math behind how to calculate for these things. The law is also clear. I'm talking about Bush versus Bush Construction. There's no evidence that any consulting shares were issued or existed at any point in time, and therefore they cannot form the basis of a damages award. Now, we certainly also, and you've read the briefing, I'm sure, I can see I'm running out of time, we do have issues with the rest of how the jury calculated. There was, but that's covered in the briefing, but the largest part of it is the 4.8 for the imaginary shares. Looking at my time, thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
And please, the court. Good morning. I'm Richard Snyder. I'm representing Mr. Foss in this appeal. Mr. Savage's appeal asserts many of the same themes that he advanced at trial and which the jury rejected. And I'll begin with this whole imaginary shares concept. That was certainly his factual argument at trial, and the jury considered it and rejected it. Mr. Savage's attorney got an impossibility instruction from the court with the very idea that his defense was going to be it was impossible for him to provide these consulting shares because they're imaginary, they don't exist. Well, the jury heard all the evidence and ruled against that.
What is the evidence that they exist? I struggled in reading, frankly, both briefs to get a good handle on the damage evidence that was presented in this case.
Well, they're shares of a corporation. They are shares that, if they didn't exist, he would have an obligation to produce anyway. If he promises to provide something, it's really no defense to say that doesn't exist. Well, you promised to provide it, so provide the value of that to me at least. But the fact of the matter is, these are companies that are issuing shares. The shares are out there. For whatever reason, Mr. Savage chose not to go out and get those and bring them back. Maybe they weren't offered on the same terms as he thought he'd be able to get them, but the fact of the matter is they are there and he just didn't provide them.
And the contract required him to go, as I understand the contract,
right.
And your argument is that he was required to go get them.
Right.
And if
right.
he didn't, that's on him, not on your client? Is that
right.
the sum and substance of it?
That's on him. And the jury, if it was impossible to perform these, the jury would have so concluded. So as a factual matter, the jury rejected this very argument that's being raised here.
So I'm looking at the special verdict form and the numbers that are filled in there by the jury. And where did those numbers come from?
The numbers for the damages?
Yes.
Yeah, those were all supported by the expert testimony that was provided at trial.
So Mr. Lamb?
Pardon me?
Mr. Lamb, I think.
It was the expert, Mr. Lamb.
And then the forensic accounting reports were also submitted and received?
Yeah, those came in as well. So the jury had all of that in front of it when it decided these issues.
Can you address appellant's argument that the expert made incorrect assumptions in calculating the damages?
That was certainly an argument that was raised. They had an opportunity at a trial to point out any errors, and so it became a factual issue then for the jury to resolve, and the jury resolved it. The factual errors that they point to are relatively minor, and they try to spin that into, you get to rescind the entire contract because of an error, and that's certainly not the case. Any errors are correctable in the damages award. Since we asked questions about fraud, I just thought I would touch on that. You know, one of the issues that was raised in the briefing was that the district court applied the wrong standard and applied some sort of heightened standard of proof, and that's just not the case. What the trial court did was, first of all, acknowledge that it hadn't been pled under the Rule 9 standards. But then that wasn't the basis of the decision. The basis of the decision was that not that they failed to meet some sort of threshold, heightened threshold of evidence. The problem was they didn't offer any evidence at all of the essential elements of their fraud claim. So they didn't identify, you know, when was this promise of full funding made? What exactly was said? Because it's inconsistent with what the agreements actually say. The agreements state what funding obligations are being made.
Well, that's the heart of the misrepresentation, though, is it not? Is that the statements were made not reflected in the contracts that induced the respondent to in fact enter into the contracts to his detriment.
Yeah. But what were those statements and what exactly was said? And there's just no evidence of that. But there's also a lack of evidence of the other essential elements of a fraud claim. Reliance. Mr. Savage admitted at his deposition that any promise made by Foss to fund transactions in the future was subject to Mr. Foss's due diligence in looking at it, and that he could decline to fund something in the future. It was a conditional promise, in other words. And that's actually what happened with the Cointel investment. Mr. Foss went out and talked to the company afterwards, and he testified about this at his trial at page 187 of the transcript. He went out and talked to the company and found out that the company didn't have the licenses to really operate the business, and found out that the financial information that Mr. Savage had provided was inaccurate. So Mr. Foss wisely chose not to further invest in the entity. That's not fraud. And the other major problem is that these future investments were all future acts, and that's not a basis for a fraud claim, unless you can prove that at the time the statement was made, there was no intent to perform that. And that's certainly not, there's zero evidence of that. And finally, there's really zero evidence of any damages or causation for these fraud claims. Mr. Savage testified that if Mr. Foss didn't fund these transactions, Mr. Savage went out and found other investors to do that. So he hasn't alleged that there's been any harm whatsoever in this alleged failure to fund fully the transactions.
Switching to the issue of the DRVD transactions and the appellant's argument that the district court erred by kind of sua sponte granting summary judgment on the counterclaims concerning that transaction. What's your response to that argument?
It's a very confusing argument, and I think it's confusing because the way it's been presented in the briefs is that they're trying to mush together two separate things. And so I think it's important to kind of keep these things separate that they're talking about. And the first thing is the issue of whether the DRVD contracts themselves, you know, which are in the record and in the appendix, constitute a settlement agreement. That's one issue. And then the second issue is this argument that they're making now on appeal is that the conduct of the parties constitutes an accord and satisfaction. So they're kind of mushing those together, so it's hard. But when you separate them out, you can see there's no error whatsoever. First of all, on this issue of whether the contracts themselves constituted a settlement, no, they plainly don't. And the district court was correct that they plainly don't. The stated consideration for those contracts to assign the DRVD warrants to Mr. Savage, the stated consideration is this consulting agreement that the parties entered into, not any sort of settlement. And importantly, there's an integration clause in there that says that this is the entire agreement and there's no other verbal unstated agreements or understandings between the parties. So that the district court was 100% correct in concluding that that those agreements themselves are not settlements, and therefore he can't come into trial and argue that they are. That would just be confusing. That's a Rule 403 issue. That would be prejudicial and confusing to the jury. So it's a ruling on a motion in limine in which he didn't make an offer of proof then either. So I think just for that reason alone, you can't review a motion in limine when the party hasn't made an offer of proof. But the second part of this, then, that gets confusing is Savage is pursuing a similar argument that this, under a different theory, that this accord and satisfaction theory. He asserted that the conduct of the parties, the parties agreed to a substitution of the performance of the payments on the written agreements. And I think it's page 38 of their brief that's kind of critical on this, because they express exactly what their theory is. And I apologize, but I'll quote from it. It says, the parties had reached an agreement that the reduced pricing that he, Savage, obtained for Foss on the DRVD transactions constituted an accord and satisfaction that was apparent in their conduct. So he's focusing on the conduct now in order to establish the settlement. And the trial court fully allowed him to proceed with that theory. At trial, Savage requested an accord and satisfaction jury instruction and was given the accord and satisfaction jury instruction. At trial, Savage actually argued to the jury in the closing arguments that there was an accord and satisfaction, and the court put the question to the jury directly in special verdict form question 10. Did the parties reach an agreement to satisfy the contractual duties owed by Savage to Foss? And the answer no to that. And the jury also found he was liable on these agreements, so necessarily impliedly finding that, rejecting the argument that there was an accord and satisfaction. So Savage got the trial on this issue that he wanted. The jury simply found against him. This isn't a grounds for a new trial in any of this. And then the other thing I wanted to touch on is this instruction that came in. It's for personal investments. The standard of review, of course, on the court's formulation of a jury instruction is highly deferential. The court has broad discretion in formulating instructions. And this particular instruction was necessary because Savage repeatedly argued in this case that the debts he owed to Mr. Foss should be credited against profits that Mr. Foss had made on his own individual investments. Now, right out of the gate on the opening arguments, that was the argument that was made. The court, there was an objection. The court sustained the objection because it's not proper. But throughout this trial, it kept coming up again and again and again. Now, what's at issue here is not the group of transactions in which Foss would loan money to Mr. Savage, and then he would invest, and then they would have an agreement to, split the consulting shares that came out of that. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about transactions where Mr. Foss directly went to the company and purchased, separate and apart from his dealings with Mr. Savage. And those are the transactions. He bought Leaf Buyer stock in that manner. And so these are not transactions.
In addition to the purchases that
he made through Mr.
Savage. I mean, my concern about the instruction is it talks about direct investments, and during appellant's argument, he opened his argument by saying one of the fundamental pieces of the factual pieces you need to understand, court, is that these were all direct investments. And so how did this jury instruction appropriately instruct the jury to separate out in the
The heading of the, it says direct, the text of the instruction says personal investments. And that's what we were talking about here, his personal investments. And this is an issue that he's confusingly trying to tie together with his accord and satisfaction issue and argue that, this instruction undercut his accord and satisfaction claim. But there were separate issues. This Foss's personal investments in these companies directly has nothing to do with what the alleged accord and satisfaction is, which is that, the DRVD transactions were intended to be an accord and satisfaction. So they're separate things, and this instruction did not create any confusion.
On the topic of the damages award, I think one of the last statements counsel made during his argument in chief was that the exclusion of part of the testimony from appellant's expert rendered the damages evidence insufficient or maybe incomplete in a way that wasn't fair to his client, wasn't fair to the appellant. How do you respond to that?
I don't think that his expert was actually prevented from saying anything. I think this is, you know, repeatedly through this case, the trial court would make rulings, and you know, Mr. Savage and his counsel would basically power through them and get in the testimony he wanted to anyway. So the items that the district court said were not permitted from the expert, they went ahead and presented that anyway. And you read through the transcript, and all that evidence came in.
So you would say there's no prejudice from the district court's ruling because the evidence got in anyway?
Yeah, the evidence came in. They haven't identified, you know, what it is that would have changed that. Their theory was not, their theory was that these are imaginary shares. I mean, that's their damages theory here, and that's just not the case. The final conclusion is, you know, this final point is this rescission claim. And obviously rescission is an equitable remedy, and it's the trial court's decision to make that decision. And the trial court made it following all of the evidence. So this is on the JMOL stage. After all the evidence came in, the court looked at it and said there's no grounds for rescinding because a party can't seek rescission of a contract it has ratified and affirmed. And the court went on and explained, you know, every way in which Mr. Savage has ratified this contract, including admitting on trial that it was valid, accepting all the benefits of this, and paying this, and extending it twice. This was a proper argument for, or proper decision for the trial court to make. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning once again. I know I have a lot to go through in 5 minutes. I first want to try to answer your question, Your Honor, from earlier. And in the brief time that I had while my adversary was speaking with you, I found docket number 93, page 56 through 57, docket 93, 214 to 222. Also page 41, these are all from docket 93. Didn't have a ton of time, but that's what I got for you in that amount of time. What I'd like to address, given this time, is the argument made by my adversary about this promise to provide the consulting shares in that they apparently, whether or not they exist, he should have gone out and found imaginary shares and provided them. We disagree on the notion that just because Mr. Foss writes them into a contract that they necessarily exist. We definitely disagree that the jury can find a value to those. Our expert was not permitted to value that. You know, here the record can only contain, to an extent, what yes, I was able to get in while overpowering through the district court's rulings, but there's an awful lot that is not a part of the record as a result of those rulings. Nevertheless, and I'm already low on time here, just if I can point you to page 41 of our brief, I'll try to find the spot that I'd like to call the court's attention to. While I'm doing that, it's contingent on the full funding. That's how it all ties together. On page 41, where I'm speaking about the jury's award of excessive damages, Foss and his expert, this is the bottom paragraph, they both admitted that there's no evidence that they exist. And I already mentioned the Bush case, but I'd like to also call the court's attention to Polaris. The thing is, a party seeking lost profits from a breach of contract must prove that those damages are reasonably certain to have occurred and that the breach caused the loss. The reason that they didn't address it in their appellate brief is because they can't. The reason that they didn't do that at trial, even their expert said so, they can't. How can one properly provide such a value? How can an expert testify to the value of thin air? They can't. Now, I didn't get to speak about DRVD before, but I'd certainly like to perhaps finish with that. The DRVD contracts that my adversary spoke about, They came after the settlement had occurred. They came after the transactions had occurred. Not only that, they disagree with each other about which one is the entire agreement, which in and of itself should be a fact question for the jury. But the point is, and again, there's a lot of stuff that's not in the record because I wasn't able to talk about it, but it was the settlement itself is very clear based on the parties' communications, based on testimony, and based on the documented evidence that no one else, well, the testimony of Mr. Hayek in particular from DRVD, that no one else, there was no funding round at Ascent. It didn't exist. Well, how is it possible that if there was no funding round at that price, that the lowest funding round, I believe, was 20 cents, not 1 cent, how is it possible that one particular individual and only one particular individual who's not a consultant for DRVD got this deal? And how is it that they suddenly started acting again, I don't want to say they were friendly, but business associates, right afterwards? Why would Mr. Savage go do something like that right before he's about to be sued if he didn't think that it was a settlement? All evidence shows that he completely believed it was a settlement. And yes, after the fact, because it's the nature of transactions in this industry, they were required to have some sort of documentation. Otherwise, the SEC wouldn't have been okay with it. They could have never traded those shares. There's no point in getting shares at such a value if you can't later trade them. That's why they needed to be, as they liked to call it, papered later. And yes, that's what those three conflicting documents show. Clearly, it's a jury question. Thank you for your time, Your Honors.
Thank you. We will have our decision out within the 90 days. Thank you very much.